had I been born before 1543, some of the children in the congregation believe that I was born before 1543, I would not have been able to figure out that the earth revolves around the sun. I would definitely have assumed, with the earth-centered people who believed from common knowledge of the day and all the observation of the world that they could muster, that the sun revolves around the earth. And common wisdom would have been my refuge. If you'd asked me, I would have said, just look. But I would have been wrong. And I don't know that it would have made any difference in my life whatsoever that my mental model of the universe was simply faulty. I likely would have done everything exactly the same with or without this piece of truth. But you can't, in the 20th century or the 21st century, get into a rocket or to an airplane overseas with the assumption that the sun revolves around the earth. The underlying assumptions of human knowledge are sometimes simply wrong. And the fact that everyone believes it to be true does not make it true. The book of Leviticus, which we begin tonight in the Torah, points us in a figurative fashion towards one of these assumptions. Now, let me explain to you one of my bugaboos after being a rabbi for a couple of years. It's the idea that since we humans are incapable of proving God's existence, and we therefore cannot be certain of the spiritual in life, we should live our lives as though God does not exist. Which is to say, lack of certainty means that we should reject the idea for many people. And I hear it all the time. Well, I can't prove that God exists, Rabbi, so frankly, I don't know whether to believe or not. And so, sure, I'll pray for those who are sick. What difference does that make? But live as though there's a God in my life who commands me to act? Too risky for me. As the saying goes, I'd like to have a dime for every time I've heard someone say that. What happened? Well, historically, it's simply this. A guy by the name of René Descartes came along and said in Latin, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Meaning that the only thing that we could know for certain is that you are thinking your thoughts and I am thinking my thoughts, and I can prove that to you, but with absolute philosophical certainty, that's pretty much where it ends. We cannot actually prove anything else if by proof you mean philosophical truth. And what that actually means is that we must doubt all knowledge. After all, we live in the state of Kansas. And we should be constantly questioning our assumptions. But we don't have to cease knowing just because we have doubt. We are obligated to question, but we are not obligated to reject because doubt exists. And how has this affected us? Well, like Copernicus's theory that the earth revolves around the sun, locating all reality in the brain has led to extremely important conclusions. And among the most important is one that I would say is quite simply wrong. Descartes' assertion, I think, therefore I am, led people to believe that all reality is centered in me, in the individual, in the self. And it's a huge error with enormous consequences. Just because what I identify is real is centered in my brain does not mean that I am the most important existence, even to myself. Looking out for number one may really be a huge error if by number one I mean the self. Religious thinkers, for instance, agree that diminishing the importance of the self is necessary to lead us to God. Or to put it differently, if you're the most important existence in your life, there's no place left for God. You know, we talk about ourselves as if we know who we are, which is to say, when I say to you a self, I'm assuming that you conjure up some image about who you are, and you think that you know something about that. But we all know, if you're honest about it, that we are a mystery, even to ourselves. We think we know our minds, and then we change them. We engage in activities without comprehending our motivation. And then we seem to not even be able to change and head in a different direction when we know that activity is bad for us. How many of you have been on multiple diets? There must be something else at work than simply the mind and the self. We think we know how we feel, but suddenly we don't. If you're in love, the whole world is a wonderful place. And if you're not, the whole world can suddenly look like there is a cloud hanging over it. We believe that we're in love with someone and then have that feeling that love has fled, and somehow or another, it colors not just our view of that person, but everything else. More than that, unwanted thoughts and desires intrude in our thinking, and we would love to do without them. But we don't seem to be able to banish them from our thoughts. If you believe Freud, and what Jew doesn't, the self is comprised not only of the conscious, but of the unconscious that prevents us from comprehending our true selves. Like the angel with the fiery sword that guards against our return to the Garden of Eden, there is something standing between ourselves and full comprehension that we cannot move past. And yet, we erroneously, as in the pre-Copernican world, that thought that the sun revolved around the earth, constantly act as though the self is our be-all and our end-all, that somehow what the self tells me to do is right, when we don't even know how to define that, which has led to the worship and exaltation of the self. Many of us, most of us, believe that we should serve ourselves first, even beyond food, drink, and shelter. We need to serve this person, the self that exists in the world. And you, my neighbor, and sometimes even those we claim to love, are in second or third or tenth place. We believe that what we want claims first place in our lives, even when it pollutes our loving. What then do I mean? We begin the reading of this third book of the Torah, Leviticus. This is the book that our ancestors used, believe it or not, as the introduction to the Torah. When a four-year-old child picked up the first book of Torah in order to learn, this is where they started, with the first chapter of the book of Leviticus. And the traditional answer to why is it that children begin here with this conceptually very difficult book is, children are pure, so let them study the laws of purity. But I have a different reason. This book is about the essential ingredient to finding meaning in our lives. Give up the self, or at least try to diminish the self, and you will find that your life can have ultimacy in a way that was hidden from you before. The first seven chapters of Leviticus give us the laws of sacrifices. For most of my career, I thought that these laws were just boring, we have to get through them, they're not worth much of our time. But now I see an essential ingredient to the laws of sacrifice. They're about giving back. Why did our ancestors sacrifice animals and vegetables and grains and oils and incense? They displayed a profound gratitude. Here they worshiped a god so beneficent, so benevolent, as to provide them with fruit trees that produce more fruit even when you take the fruit off the tree. God provides so the grains can be cultivated, and you can pick the grain and reseed and come back to the very same place next year and eat again. And God provided domesticated animals that we can nurture and they will reproduce themselves and we can continue to eat. Suppose they couldn't seed and they couldn't plant. They couldn't feed themselves or raise livestock. They'd be nomadic wanderers as their ancestors were, simply wandering around looking for food to meet their daily needs. But God's beneficence enabled them to feed themselves continuously as long as they had respect for the land that fed them. In offering sacrifices, they theoretically at least put God at the center as their provider, not themselves and saying, look at what I did, look at the work of my hands. But God, who gave them the capacity, was at the center of existence. They had a diminished role, for without God, they could not live. We human beings know for certain that certain things are required for living. We need water, we need food, we need shelter, and we need meaning. Meaning is a reason to get out of bed in the morning. Meaning, beyond food, shelter, clothing, water, keeps us going. Meaning provides us with the will to push ahead with our lives. It is not some mere addition to being a human being. If you cannot construct meaning, you will languish and fail and find yourself unable to take care of yourself. Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz writes about what it means to be a human being. Throughout life, he writes, one asks the same question in many forms, but one never really extricates himself from the context of the issue. Who am I? And from its corollaries, where do I come from? Where am I going? What for? And why? Or as God said to Adam and later on to Cain, Ayeka, where are you? We discover that in order to survive, we must have some meaning in our lives. We must have an answer to why we are here. Three primary means exist to give our lives meaning. Those three are loving, giving your life to something larger than yourself, and giving to someone else or something else altruistically. And all of these, loving selflessly, giving your life to something larger than yourself that will go on forever, giving altruistically, all of these require diminishing the importance of the self in favor of the other. And here's what we miss. That's the plan. If that, in fact, is the way we are, and I believe that it is, then God created us that way. There is a creator, and there is an order. And when you forget about either, you find yourself confused and not knowing where to turn. Whatever it is that created us also consciously planted within us this need to attach ourselves to another existence beyond the self, whatever that is, whether it be through selfless, unconditional loving or building something into life that is beyond ourselves and more important than ourselves, that is so worthwhile that it will outlast our bodies and make a contribution to humanity, or without regard to self, giving another human being something that that person needs for the simple reason that that person is needy and you have the opportunity. Think about the fact that you could walk along a street and pick up a random piece of trash and put it in a receptacle on the street, and you feel good about yourself. Something as simple as that, a minor altruistic act, makes us feel good and righteous. All of these, loving, attaching ourselves to a greater cause, and altruism, giving selflessly to others, enable us to create a reason to exist beyond the fact that we have water and shelter and clothing and food. And they give us something greater than ourselves that will continue on after us, and thus answer for us the question, Ayeka, where are you, that God asks persistently throughout our lives. In my belief, all of this is no coincidence. If you discover an order in creation, then God put it there, and it testifies to God's intention. I don't need a proof beyond Descartes that God exists. I only need to be able to be alert enough to see the plan as it functions in my life. The God that we cannot absolutely scientifically prove, created in such a way that we must have meaning in our lives. And because we have to have meaning, we have the ability to obtain that meaning. We cannot exalt the self, we must diminish the self and thereby enable ourselves to thrive. There's a message here. At the essential core of life, we must de-emphasize ourselves and bind ourselves to others. It may be that I cannot prove to you that God exists, but that's an old question, and I'm so tired of hearing it. And Descartes said it, 250 years ago? It's old news. There's nothing that is absolutely provable. Get over it. But I can see God's hand not only in creation, but in the characteristics of the human being, and that is proof enough for me.